In 1975, Jaws was released. It is routinely regarded as one of the greatest films of all time and is generally credited with creating the concept of the summer blockbuster. In 1978, in an obvious cash grab, Jaws 2 was released, failing to have lightning strike a second time, but presenting a generally enjoyable film. In 1983, Jaws 3D was released, shamelessly attempting to take advantage of a gullible audience. By 1987, there was no pretense of quality as Lorraine Gary and Michael Caine cashed paychecks for sleepwalking through a pointless and incredulous sequel. In 2016, Paul Spitero created Is It Jaws, in which he and a group of rotating guest hosts discuss new and old movies and place them up against the Jaws scale, which ignores some elements of the actual films and sets forth a rating scale. Jaws, an all-time great classic film. Jaws 2, an enjoyable film with some flaws but worthy of multiple viewings. Jaws 3, a moderately enjoyable film. And finally, Jaws 4, a bad movie. Please join Paul and his guests as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Someday when people look at me, they'll say, there goes Roy Hobbs, the best there ever was.
TriStar Pictures presents Robert Redford in The Natural, the story of a father and a son.
You got a gift, Roy, but it's not enough.
Of love.
He means the world to me.
And desire.
I'm not waiting for true love to come along, Roy.
A champion.
A Roy Hobbs comes along once, maybe twice in everybody's lifetime.
And his destiny.
With or without the records, they'll remember you.
Best there is now, and best there ever will be.
I wouldn't bet against me.
I already have.
Robert Redford, Robert Duvall, Glenn Close, Kim Basinger, Wilford Brimley, Barbara Hershey, Robert Prosky, and Richard Farnsworth as Red. The Natural.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? I'm Paul Spitero, and I was just sitting here making up my list, my depth charts for my fantasy baseball draft tomorrow night, but I decided to interrupt it to talk to some of my baseball friends. Now, first we have over in the Cleveland Guardians stands, Mr. Sean Whalen.
It is a pleasure to be here, as always.
It's a pleasure to have you. And over at the Brewers Stadium, we have John and Maggie Schaefer-Hames. Hey, guys.
Hey, Paul.
Yeah, it'll always be Miller Park, never American Family Field.
I hate that they get money from sponsors instead of having...
It's just gross. I know, have a real name.
But Miller Park, you could almost buy.
That'd be Miller Park. It is
the
beer,
Brewers.
It's Wisconsin.
You know.
Yeah. No, that was okay. That was before the sponsors totally took over.
Yeah. Yes.
It took me forever to remember not to call it County Stadium. And now I have to call it American Family.
I feel like I kind of have a halfway thing with the Mets because I don't like that Citibank sponsors the stadium, but Citi Field just kind of sounds like a regular stadium. And
it does.
It doesn't sound quite like, you know,
Tropicana Park or whatever.
Yeah.
It is.
Or yeah. And you know, it's.
It'll never call be it the Trop all like you that. Want. It's still named after orange juice.
Anita Bryant would be happy. If anybody's old enough to remember those commercials that she used to do. But in honor of baseball season, we're here today to do another baseball movie. And Sean requested or recommended or begged, I'm not sure which one it was, that we do The Natural. So that's what we're looking at. And I'm going to give my initial takes on this because I saw this when it was in the movie theater back in 1984. And in my youthful arrogance, I did not like it. I thought it was just a little ridiculous. I thought that some of the elements of it were just too far-fetched. I couldn't take it. And for the last, well, what is it now, 40-something years, I've been saying, you know, how do people like this movie? What the hell is wrong with them? But, you know, I try to keep an open mind, and I watched it at Sean's request. And shockingly, I don't think that same thing that I could have sworn a month ago that I thought about it. I found it to be charming this time. I found it to be very much a throwback type movie. And I really, really enjoyed it. So that said, Sean, when did you first see this one?
So I saw it in the theater like you, and it was a film that I just clearly by the fact that I asked if we could do this film at some point, it's a film that I really enjoy. There's a lot of reasons why I think it's a good film for us to do here, though, because I know over the years that in seeing the movie, especially when it's one that you enjoy, I've got a lot of friends of mine that have felt very differently about this film than I have. Their journey with this film has been very different. And sometimes those are great films to talk about just because there's a lot of different perspectives to share about this. This is one of my favorite films, but I also acknowledge the fact that people can engage with this film in very, very different ways. So I enjoy hearing those kind of thoughts and conversations around a film. So I thought this might be a fun one to talk about for those particular reasons.
Yeah, with that in mind, and considering my take the two times I've seen it, I could actually debate with myself whether it's good. John, when did you first see this one?
At some point in the 80s, I think it was on television when it was probably first aired. I specifically remember watching it with my dad at one point, and I remember him. My dad was one of those people who could not wrap his brain around the fantastic elements of it. Because I think I remember the scene in Chicago where he breaks the clock. He's like, "Oh, come on!" But I've seen it many times since then. My opinion of it is all over the place at different times. So I will be debating myself because just in the sense of the questions of, do I think this is a good movie? Do I like this movie? And do I like watching this movie are all different questions. And all of those are different questions from, is it Jaws? So we'll address all of that and hopefully hash something out by the end of this. Mm-hmm.
All of this and more on, yes, Is It Jaws? How about you, Maggie?
I either saw it roughly 10 years ago or just yesterday. But I was watching it to prep for the podcast with John. Nothing felt super familiar. The scene with him striking out Whammer, I think, is just an iconic scene. So that one I recognize, but I have no idea. My initial opinion of it is that it's a very strange film. But I did enjoy watching it. So yeah, it'll be an interesting conversation.
Yeah, I totally agree. Now I'm going to talk about one of the things that I kind of didn't like in some ways, just to start things off, and that is the casting of Robert Redford. I thought he as Roy Hobbs was charming. I thought he was likable. I thought he was a little too naive at times, but I thought he, you know, that I really enjoyed him. And Robert Redford, at I believe 47 years old when this movie was made, easily could pass for the 35-year-old he was playing through most of the movie, mm-hmm, but could not pass for the 19-year-old that he was playing in the beginning of the movie.
That was worse than Grease.
Now, I saw it, like, I was taking specific note as I was watching it this time that it seemed like Barry Levinson went out of his way to have longer shots initially, and then, you know, have him kind of in the dark so that you wouldn't really notice it. But then they're on the train, and all of a sudden, you know, it's like a close-up, and it's like, how, you know, you really got to work a little. I know they didn't have the CGI back then, but you got to work a little harder to kind of mask the fact that he's a 47-year-old man playing a 19-year-old. Wow. And I thought that was somewhat problematic.
Soft focus was the CGI of the time.
Yeah.
And it was.
Yeah.
Or these days, they just would have given long hair.
Probably. Well, no, but these days, they would have easily de-aged him. Now they can just do that.
It's creepy, though.
Yeah. I don't.
It was weird. Signing the Indiana Jones one, I thought that that was the first one that I saw that didn't look uncanny valley, but it was so weird hearing the old man voice coming out of young man.
Yes.
But that's not the movie we're covering here.
I don't disagree with you on the fact that he doesn't look 19. I wouldn't have put a younger actor into that spot to achieve those scenes, though, because this is my personal preference, by the way, only because I liked Robert Redford in it. I liked his portrayal of Roy Hobbs. Part of what I really love about the film is Roy's likability. It's also the fact that I connected with the fact that this is a character who got kind of beat up by life. He had all this potential. He was the natural, you know, I mean, he had all this ability that we got to see from his childhood, straight on through. The Whammer sequence that you referenced earlier was a great opportunity to see him just kind of, he was larger than life. He had the
potential. He was Babe Ruth.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, potential to be the next big thing. And then it's an example of mistakes, you know, that and along the way, sometimes large, small, whatever you want to call that, led him down a path that derailed all of that potential. And years later, he found his way back to his love. And it was cool to see that piece. But for me, that connection had to be, I had to feel that was that same guy. And I know that there's so many movies that have cast a younger talent that have made me feel that's the same person. For this film, I guess I'm so invested in Robert Redford, and that doesn't mean that everybody has to agree with me, but that's where I was at. I liked his Roy Hobbs. I liked the journey of Roy Hobbs. And that's what I keep coming back to, because it's a long movie. So it's, if you're going to hang with that guy the whole time, you've got to like him. But for me, that was what kept me big of this one. So I like hanging with Roy.
I'll tell you, my first thought was it didn't feel like a long movie when I watched it. Now it's almost 2 hours and 20 minutes, but I, you know, as it was getting towards the end, I was like, oh, that's it. It's going to be over soon. I thought this was going to last a little longer, and it didn't, you know, it didn't drag at all. So, you know, I'll give Levinson credit for that, and I'll give Robert Redford credit for that. I really do feel like, you know, there was a supporting cast here, but this was a Redford movie. Nobody else has ownership of this movie at all. You know, so you know, it would give him the credit or give him the blame, you know, whatever you think of it. I think it was going to succeed or fail on his shoulders.
That's certainly true. To piggyback off what Sean was saying about his the trip or journey he's taking, I mean, this is the kind of move that kind of demands that you engage with it, you know, as a film. It really, really wants to be taken seriously. And it's really showing that, laying on the metaphors, it's really using the symbolism, especially with light throughout. I'm sure we're going to get to that. What we're talking about, the movie tells us straight out, the evil gal in the beginning asks him, have you ever read
have you ever read Homer?
And he's like, no. And it's like, oh, well, good. Then this is all going to be very new to you.
Yeah. but we're living that story now.
Roy Hobbs is a hero. He is a superhero. He is a demigod. He is Superman. He is whatever you need. And he is going through the standard hero's journey. That's why I think the fantastic elements of the movie are absolutely necessary. They're a depiction of that. That's who he is. And what we're watching through his journey is Roy has to get over the problems of his past, make peace with them in order to become a hero. Because what's the difference between a superhero and an action hero? When they show up on the scene, what's the first thing an action hero does? Mm-hmm. What?
Oh, punches the bad guy.
Yes, what's the first thing a superhero does?
Save the innocent.
Exactly, because a hero has to learn that you're not doing the things you do for yourself. You are doing it for everyone else. And there is a lot of actual subtle stuff going on in the movie where you can see the effect that Roy is having on other people that Roy himself is not noticing until he has to be steered and pointed in that direction by a character that's designed to do exactly that.
Well, so, and even on a more basic level for the hero's journey, like, you've got a guy who leaves home, he encounters a dragon, he defeats the dragon, he gets the girl.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the beginning of the movie, and just because you made mention of the evil woman at the beginning, I was a little thrown off because I think I interpreted her motivation differently than was intended, maybe. Because now I've heard it said that her motivation was to kill the best baseball players so that she'd be famous for doing it. Whereas when I was watching it, I thought she was a follower of the Whammer and shot Roy because she didn't want him to be better than the Whammer.
You know, it's the first one is closer to the mark. She was the book makes it much clearer. She has a pathological need to know what it means to win. Because she herself can't grasp that. In the meta narrative, she's an agent of darkness. Mm-hmm. She is always cloaked in shadows. She is wearing black when other characters black are veil. Not, like black veil at the point. She is there, and that's most clearly shown in a dialogue when she says, when she asks him, what does it feel? You know, because she was at that contest. I do enjoy contests of skill, she said. Mm-hmm. She was going to try to kill whichever one of them won, basically.
Okay. Yeah, and so I misinterpreted
to
whatever extent.
And when she's talking to him about it, and when she asks him, what did that feel like? Or why do you want to do this? What are you going to do with this power? And when, you know, she looked very, very excited for his answer. And when Roy says, I want to be the best baseball player that's ever been, she immediately looks deflated and disappointed by that answer. And so there's something interesting going there that could go different ways.
Did they give you an indication as to what she wanted him to say?
No, that's just kind of my take this time. I don't remember enough about the book. I know that was her motivation, because they even say it later in the, it's, you have to connect it with dialogue that was happening in the background. They had mentioned that a bunch of people had been killed with silver bullets. Mm-hmm. And then they pulled the silver bullet out for him, realizing that he was, and it was champions that were being killed. You know, it was.
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, it makes sense, but like I said, I just kind of misinterpreted it when I first watched it. And you know, it's funny because people will say, well, if you interpreted it that way, then that's what it is. And I don't believe in that. I believe that the people who created the movie, the people who wrote the story, they had a vision in mind, and it's up to me to actually see that vision.
Mm-hmm. It depends on the movie. This one.
Well, I don't like, honestly, and I've said this a few times for different things, I don't like when there's an event and you say, well, what happened? And they say, well, that's up to you to determine. No, you know, tell me a story. Don't have the scene black out and then tell me it's up to you to decide if Tony Soprano died.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, don't even get me started on that one. But in this case, I think by the direction and by the dialogue and by how she's a parallel with Kim Basinger's character later, mm-hmm. That both of them are outside. She is outside of the light. This is a conflict between good or evil. I'm going to refer to them as the light and the dark for reasons that are going to be very apparent to anyone who's seen this movie. But as an agent of the dark, she doesn't understand the light. She doesn't understand where the power comes from, you know, the lightning. And so she's trying to understand that. And since she can't, she can only destroy it. And so I think she was like hoping for a moment that maybe if she could understand, she possibly could escape this loop she'd found herself in. Mm-hmm. It's like Kim Basinger later in the movie. The parallel is when she has the gun and she's kind of just absolutely angry because she didn't have the power herself to escape the darkness and was hoping that Roy would be able to
Be the white knight,
as it were, mm-hmm. to take her, but that wasn't his role right. for her.
Nope.
Hmm, interesting.
There's a lot going on in this movie.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack.
Yeah, there is, and it's great to hear you break it down a little bit. So, again, I think Redford, with the exception of not looking 19, really did a great job in this movie. I think he was charismatic. I think, again, I thought he played the character, or the way it was written, was that, you know, he was somewhat naive. He wasn't able to see the dark. Mm-hmm. You know, he saw the light in everyone and had a difficult time deciphering if they were dark. Now, eventually, they would make it clear to him where they stood, and then he would react accordingly. But he would never see it himself when they, unless they revealed it to him.
Exactly.
Well, he does say to the big bad. I keep referring to him in my head as big as the Big Lebowski. it's not the same actor, but he's just
looking. You're talking about Prosky?
Yeah.
The owner.
Right. The judge.
The judge. Yeah, that was Prosky. Yeah. He was the owner of, or the partial owner of the team, who wanted to be the whole owner. Exactly. And see Major Leagues to see the similar storyline.
Yeah, but he says, the only thing I know about the dark is that you can't see in it.
Yeah, that's...
And that really sums up a big part of Roy's whole journey.
Well, the lighting, though, we've referred to. Every time, Roy is almost exclusively... lit. Every time he's in a scene, you see his face. There's a lot of light on it. The only time he's ever silhouetted is when he's in the presence of a character in the dark. Mm-hmm. In the beginning, when he's on the train, the silhouette is there. When you know he's with the judge, and remind me later, we can have a talk about the names of the characters. But and the only time that it isn't a character in the dark doing it is when he's in the presence of Iris. Named for the part of your eye which mm-hmm. lets the light in
so that you can see
is there to enlighten him, to mm-hmm. tell him exactly
literally
what he's unable to do.
Yes.
And her light is so bright that even his light is dimmed.
She stands
in
up
presence.
In that crowd. That's actually so cool. She stands up in that crowd, and she's the only person who's lit, and like she's got a halo.
Well, I mean, it's just
nobody else is the same
like,
way.
Did you get that?
We're not being subtle, but that's okay. My whole thing was like the symbolism in this movie is not subtle at all, but that's all right. Like, it doesn't need to be subtle. Like, if it's a good movie for, you know, film studies 101 students to watch to kind of grok it, that all the better. And that didn't detract, I don't think, at all from my enjoyment of the movie. I thought it was fun picking out all the symbols and the metaphors and the
episodes. Well, it is kind of my first metaphor movie.
It is a little, yeah. Baby's first metaphor.
It would be good to show in a film's studies class for that reason.
100%.
Because it's one that's impossible not to tell that there's something, and light and dark are easy metaphors to spot.
Yeah.
So once you started doing it, and then
you never stop seeing it anywhere.
Well, and then, you know, just kind of playing with that, and it's kind of fun from that aspect when Roy Hobbs goes over and opens up all the blinds in the judge's chambers, and mm-hmm. and he reacts like a vampire trying to slinking away from the
turn
light.
Off that infernal.
Infernal,
light,
yes,
says.
He uses the word infernal quite noticeably, yes.
Yeah, so I mean, it's like you say, it's not subtle, but it's fun.
But it's fun.
And that wasn't the fantastical element that bothered me. And I was very superficial at the time. I was bothered by the fact that he'd knocked the cover off the ball. I was bothered by the fact that he put out every light in the stadium. Like it was like, you know, okay, they just took it too far. I was like the way your dad was when he hit the clock. You know, it just seemed a little too far gone to me at the time. And now watching it, I had a totally different perspective. And as we were talking about earlier, I don't think when we were doing this recording, it felt to me like a movie that could have been made in the 1950s mm-hmm. as opposed to the 80s. The lighting elements that you talked about, the scene composition, the score, everything about it just felt very, not old-fashioned, but more classic. And I really enjoyed that aspect of it so much more this time than, you know, when I was younger and didn't really appreciate it as much.
I agree with you on that. It's, God, I was going to address something you were saying in the middle of that. It's the book was, that's the other thing. The book was a contemporary story. It was written in the 1950s. The period piece elements were the flashback stories, which were more extensive. But they were telling a story of at the time. The tone of it was very different. It was much more of a just the darkness was much more real. It was much of a more Bull Durham-y feel, the book. And but this one is definitely a period piece, a nostalgia piece, which works because I think it's telling that it takes place in 1939, right? Because it's the last year of innocence. It's before World War II starts.
Yep.
And after World War II, everything is different. America can still, at 1939, we're still very, you know, boyish, rather cusp. So if you want to take the movie as a metaphor for America, we could probably be here all night. Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, we were in the Depression in 1939 still.
It's true.
So, yes. You know, America was a very difficult place to live at that time. Mm-hmm. Not that, you know, I am old, but I did not experience that.
Were the names different in the book than you mentioned the names earlier? And I'm fascinated by the fact that when you were mentioning the book, were the names different in the book?
I think they were the same. The book is far more directly the Odyssey. Okay. It is really the Odyssey.
I would anticipate that.
It's why the sports bet.
Gus. He's the Cyclops, right?
He's Cyclops, yeah.
That's what I thought. I'm like, well, he's a guy with the funky eye. Like, clearly he's supposed to be the Cyclops. Just like in Oh, Brother Art, though.
Which, the other one that's ostensibly based on the Odyssey.
Right.
This, I don't see the Odyssey in this telling as much. And even in the book, I think it's a stretch. But he was definitely going for the metaphors.
Yes.
Right, and the characters. That's why one of the characters is named after the bad girl is named after the Circe, or after the what's it? Not Circe, but the other bad girl in the
Odyssey. See, the only other one I can think of is Scylla and Charybdis, neither of which were actual, like, people.
Anyway.
Yeah.
But the names, besides Roy, you know, who is just Roy Everyman. I mean, so you've got Pops.
Who's clearly the father figure.
He's there too. Mm-hmm. Iris is, as we said, you know, she's an angel. She's there to bring the message to her. We got Red. There's always a character named Red who is exactly like that.
Yeah, but I love that actor. He's so sweet.
We're going to talk about the specific actors in a moment. So.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Sorry.
No, that's okay. I told you we're going into the middle. And I'm going to start by naming one of the actors. Mm-hmm. And it was another moment that kind of made me roll my eyes when I was younger. And maybe you could explain to me how in the book they kind of made this part of the hero's journey or explained it in the symbolism to me, because even this time I didn't really see it. And that's Michael Madsen as Bartholomew Bump Bailey. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was watching this the first time and he ran through the wall and died. And I thought, oh, that's ridiculous.
That's so weirdly, that's the only, if I have a criticism of the movie of a bit that I think it's the tone there. Is very bizarre. It would be
the only thing I could take from that, honestly, was, you know, they talk about you know, people who are leaders, people who are inspirational, and they say, oh, this guy, you know, you'd run through a wall for this guy. So he did that, but then he died. So right. it's not like he was rewarded for doing that. Well, but you know, but he was inspired to play harder because of Roy,
right?
Because he was now being compared to him and coming up way short because he was, you know, taking the evil money and all.
His name is Bump because his character is a literal bump in the road to Roy's progress.
But yeah, I don't know if there was something more to it. I mean, I like Michael Madsen as an actor. I always have. This is before I really knew who he was. So when I saw this, like, he didn't stand out to me in that regard. But again, like I said, at the time, I thought, oh, that's just so ridiculous. This time, I just kind of shrugged my shoulders and said, okay, we'll just move on. But right. I didn't really get a lot of symbolism out of it.
He's not in it very long. He's there, I think his purpose, if I remember, it's been a long time. I think his purpose is just to kind of introduce the reader to the dark, you know, the world of the judge. And Kim Basinger's character's name is
Memo
for memory.
Mm. So,
in just, the film where I don't want to say I liked the character Bump, you're not really supposed to, but I think one of the purposes he served in the film, at least, was Roy's initially put on this team, and you've got Pop, who is not putting him on the team, and he's got these reasons for it, and Roy's age is one of them. He doesn't like the fact that this guy's been kind of forced on him. You know, it's like, again, there's a power piece where this is my team. I want to be directing my team. So I liked that piece. I think the purpose he served there was, you've got this competent player. Yes, he's cocky, and you could sit there as the viewers can kind of go, okay, he's kind of like your typical unlikable jock, but he's competent on the field. It's actually the reason why, like you guys, there's a reason I have an issue with his demise. Mm-hmm. It was like, you have this very competent player that I wish there had been another resolution to getting him out of that spot and Roy taking it over. Just because of the fact that there's so much in this film that it's over the top that I'm kind of like, oh, it's magical, over the top, superhero-y and all that. And I like that stuff, actually. But that was one where it took me out of it. And it's the only, I love this film, and I'll openly say that piece. But if there's a scene where I have a criticism for it, it's that one, because that one, every time I see it, it takes me out of it. Mm-hmm. Just mm-hmm. that motion, and I get back in, but it's always like, really? And it's funny, considering everything we're saying with the cover being knocked off the ball and all that stuff, I'm kind of like, oh, I'm fine with that. But him running through there, and now he's gone and no longer with us, was the one for me. I don't know why that one does lingeringly stick with me, and I'm like, I have a problem with that scene. Yeah. I don't have a problem with the character, but I have a problem with that scene.
So it probably would have been much, much more corny. But I would have found it much more satisfying if somehow Roy had inspired him to play harder mm-hmm. for the right reasons mm-hmm. and that he somehow like made a game-saving catch by, you know, jumping into the wall or whatever, but was injured in a way where he wasn't mm-hmm. going to be able to play. So that took him out of Roy's way as far as competition on the field. But like, as he's being taken off, you see him like, you know, I did it, Roy. I caught it or whatever, like that he was trying to get Roy's approval.
Yeah. Right.
Because Roy was inspiring to him. Mm-hmm. Like, that would have been, like I said, it would have been corny. I'm not going to try and deny it. But I think I would have liked that better.
I would have believed it more, yeah.
But he had to be completely out of the way so that Roy and Kim Basinger, and Memo could get together.
Mm-hmm. Otherwise, well, she's evil, though. She could have just abandoned him when he was out of the game. But
she isn't evil. I wouldn't say she's evil in the beginning. I think because they very deliberately put her in a balanced white and black ensemble. Yep. She's kind of being influenced by both of them and kind of has the opportunity to either go to the light or the darkness, but grab what makes her choice. And I think the best scene of that is when she calls him on the phone and she's wearing black. And she says, she lies to him saying, I'm just lying here in my white teddy.
Slip.
My white slip, sorry. And, you know, that's about as, you know, on the nose as you can get with what's going on there. She's made her choice by that point. But
I'm going to jump to actually Kim Basinger and Glenn Close at the same time. And, you know, they're both significant, but to me, they both are just supporting players, but supporting players that don't even have, they have a huge role in the story, but they aren't huge parts as far as screen time and all of that. Mm-hmm. And I saw under awards, it said Glenn Close was now nominated for Best Supporting Actress. Mm-hmm. And Kim Basinger was nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actress. And not that I thought either one gave a subpar performance. I thought they were both fine. But I didn't think either of them had enough screen time or key moments where they were like chewing up the scenery a little bit or whatever, that they would stand out to be award winners on it. I think they serve the purpose of just being kind of the motivating factors behind Roy's behavior and plot devices mostly. I thought they were fine in the roles, but I didn't see nominating them for supporting actress.
I disagree, but go ahead.
I would say there is one moment for sure that really stood out to me when Glenn Close's character with Iris when she and Roy are talking in her apartment, mm-hmm. and she mentions that she has a son, and he asks about the dad, I think.
His dad's in New York.
And yeah. in a very brief moment, Glenn Close does a really good job of telling us that she's just deciding to lie about this now. She makes a certain face before mm-hmm. she delivers the line about the dad living in New York that makes it like and that's what tripped me, or like that's what I caught on to immediately, was like, oh, it's his kid and she's lying about it because of this funny face she's making.
No, his dad did live in New York. He was playing for the New York Knights.
Yes, exactly. Right. Yeah. And so that I thought was a very good part of her performance. But I would agree, neither one of them do a whole lot considering how important their characters are to the story, but they don't have a lot to actually do or say. They don't have a lot of lines.
I think they gave an Oscar quality performance. I mean, if you know, they gave Judi Dench one for the 5 seconds that she's in Shakespeare in Love. So, but that's Judi Dench also. I really, really like
sometimes their Lifetime Achievement Awards.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
This was
that wasn't for either of them. They were both relatively young at this point.
There were. And this was really showing Kim's potential that you never really got to see again until LA Confidential reminded you that, oh, she is a good actor. They just keep casting her as a bimbo. Because I thought she was amazing, especially at the end with she's waving the gun around and the just the desperation and the all of it. You know, she seemed like a real character. You could tell even she was wearing on her face the journey she had made to get to the point she had gotten without even having to bother with dialogue or showing, not telling, if you will. I thought they were both very, very good.
You also really need her character because you've got like this book ending with Iris's character. You know, you've got the childhood of Roy, or, you know, the youthful Roy, where he started off with the light and made these promises. I'm going to send for you. And, you know, all those pieces, you know, back from his past. And he headed down, because of circumstance, the dark path, you know, that led him to get shot. And yeah, he didn't die there, but that stuck with him. That darkness was infecting him throughout the entire film. Enter the character of Kim and Memo and what was going on there. You have to believe that he was intrigued by her, enthralled by her. You have to believe there was something about her that would keep him coming back to her. Otherwise, when Iris enters into the picture, it doesn't matter. You've got to have this feeling of, boy, now Roy has to make a choice. And he starts to wean off of Memo.
Right.
I thought Iris was like so different from Memo that and like kind of this pure kind of, it was a chance. It was almost like for him getting a glimpse back at who he once was.
I think you
could have been. And this is a chance, like at a second shot of he's back playing baseball. He's got a chance for everything that he could have been. Everything, it's coming full circle. And he has a choice there. He could have kept going down the path with Memo. Mm-hmm. And I think as a viewer, you could sit there and see why he would consider doing that with her performance. But he weaned off and she knew it. And we got to see that as the viewer in the fact that she was lying at certain points in time to try and cover that this was falling apart. And you got to believe Glenn Close in order to do that. It was I really enjoyed both.
It's the reason I think that Roy falls for Memo that he's supposed to, and I think her name is Memo for this reason, is that she embodies the qualities of both of the women that he has been involved with, the light one and the dark one, which is shown in her dialogue. She has that sexy kind of dark, mysterious aspect, but also she has a very kind of wholesome look to her at her base. So he thinks that she's reminding him of, you know, of Iris, but it turns out it's the other one. That's at the end. He said, I was wrong.
And whenever he becomes enraptured by her or caught up in her, he slumps. He starts to do badly. Right. And exactly. You know, like you would think he might realize, that's a problem. But, you know, Maggie, you mentioned the scene when she says, you know, the father's in New York and all. Yeah. And that was one of the scenes where the naivete came to me, because I'm sitting there saying, you got a 16-year-old son, huh? and his father's in New York. And I mean, was this an immaculate conception? Because otherwise, Roy, you should have some memories that that this could be your kid. How naive are you?
Yeah.
Well, he's got a lot on his mind. But also, that's part of the whole point. I think while he has to figure this out with the women, what he has to do is he has to get over his hubris at the point, at the time, you know, at, which is shown by his slumpiness at the, slumping. That's at, he's at what he thinks is his high point, and he's actually at his low point, furthest away from the light, because he's still, he's all about himself. He's enjoying this. Even when he, in the scene where he rips the cover off the ball and the rain is coming down, you can see all of the rest of the team is celebrating together on the pitcher's mound with themselves while Roy is standing on the base by himself. He has let this, made the team, you know, feel like a team for the first time, but he's not a member yet and he doesn't even see it yet. And gradually he gets like brought in, but like you've said, he doesn't know it. He's very, very thick, very self-centered, and he needs a literal angel of God to come in and go, Roy, I am the prize.
So moving on with the characters, Wilfred Brimley, I don't think I've ever seen Wilfred Brimley in something where I didn't like him.
Yeah, he's great.
Even though he's kind of a barrier to Roy initially, you still kind of, you know, you get him. And him and Richard Farnsworth, you know, Red, the two of them together, like, it makes me wish that I was a talented baseball player and those were my coaches.
Richard Farnsworth did a really good job too, with the scenes with him, of setting up, you could let Pop be crotchety for a longer stretch because he was filling in the blanks behind the scenes of why you should like him. And I thought that was great when he had those sequences with Roy where the two of them met together, because Richard Farnsworth's great anyway. And speaking of somebody else who's very likable, mm-hmm. those sequences were very endearing. But that did give Pops the freedom to be crotchety for and at certain points in time where you're kind of like, come on, let Roy have a shot. You do feel sympathetic to him at a time where he's not being super kind to our hero. and that was something that I thought Richard Farnsworth was a great vehicle to kind of deliver that piece, because his likability hinges on whether or not you're going to give Pop a little bit of a pass.
But he also served to allow Roy to give some exposition as to his character, you know, because of the conversations that they were having. He's trying to get to know Roy, and by extension, we're getting to know Roy.
Right. Yeah, Red's whole job is to give perspective. That's what he does.
Mm-hmm. And you have the idea that Red's kind of the gatekeeper. That's why he goes to dinner with him, and he's like, if you, so he say Roy, he takes one look at Roy and he's pretty much is able to say, yeah, you seem to be a decent sort.
But one of my favorite bits in the movie is when Pop's talking about nanny goats and how much he likes ducks and chickens, and he wants to have a farm. I love that bit. I thought that was funny.
Well, Pops
should have been a farmer.
Pops represents having to get over, he was him having to get over his father's death. So he has to struggle with him and then eventually reach an understanding, and then so he can help him at the end.
Red also did a really good job of continuing this idea that there are people who are recognizing there's a mystery to Roy. Like, there's something more there that is worth uncovering and worth figuring out. And I liked how his questioning was showing that, like, I think this guy might have something. And you need that person to do that in order to kind of speed through this, like, why is Roy going to eventually get on the team? And I thought Red served a really good purpose in that as well.
What do you see as the purpose of, I believe, one of the best actors of our ages, Robert Duvall? What do you see as the purpose of his character? Where is he bringing the story? Because other than the fact that he's trying to figure out who this is, and he doesn't really remember that it was the kid from years ago, and then he kind of pieces it together. But, you know, it's an interesting side story on it all, but I don't feel like it brings the narrative forward at all.
No, he's... So in the metaphor of the light versus dark, he's the agent who's neutral. Mm-hmm. He's Robert Duvall is often shown in a gray suit rather than black or white.
Almost always silhouetted
too. Yeah, not often perfect, like not often completely lit, often in the shadow of somebody else, like Whammer or like Judge, and or not Judge, Gus. Yeah. Well, and Judge eventually. Mm-hmm. But his whole thing is that he's the, I feel like he was actually the most self-serving of all of them. His whole thing was just to look out for himself, as he was number one.
Maxwell.
You know, he's kind of more of like a trickster character, like a archetype than anything else. I felt like he was more a foil, I guess, is the, not exactly a villain, but another kind of bump in the road.
Yeah, I think he's in the, in this conflict between light and dark that we have, he's the guy who thinks he can exist in both places.
Yeah.
And in this level of conflict with these agents, we can't have that. And you have to pick a side. And that's kind of what Roy is telling him at the end. He thinks he can just, you know, walk the line, have all the power, take this away. And Roy hits him with a baseball, you know, twice, just to say.
What uncanny aim he has.
He's also a connecting thread to the past. Mm-hmm. He was there for that pivotal event.
Yeah.
And also there was this guy who he'd seen that was like this prodigy that like was doing these amazing pieces. And he saw all of that. And then this person vanished. He doesn't immediately recognize that that's who Roy is. But for Roy, Roy recognized him right away. And so for Roy now, who's been internalizing this, we even see him have a dream about the bad things that happened to him. There's this guy that can unravel the fact that, like, I'm just trying to play the game again and leave that behind me, at least externally. Internally, no matter much how much he's tried to let it go, we know it's there. But externally, he's trying to be this this anonymous person who loves the game, that wants to have an opportunity to try and do this thing that he missed. And this guy is the danger of bringing back this event that caused Roy to get away from it all, run away from it all, and to a certain extent. He really can bring that back if he recognizes Roy. Roy goes out of his way to not give him any remote link to his past. But Roy's encounters with him are very clear of, I am trying to distance myself from you. I'm trying not to give you a clue of who I am. You know, and even though the guy's dancing, like Robert Duvall clearly starts dancing more and more to those pieces, but he's really one of the only ones, aside from Iris comes back in later, but he's the only one that really was there for both, you know, periods of darkness in Roy's life. So he's a connecting thread. I totally agree with you on the neutral piece, though. He's kind of like this little, like, kind of trying to figure out, you know, is he the role of the trickster and those type of pieces? I get that completely because he's certainly not one of those guys that's, you're like sitting there going, wow, what a nice guy.
All right.
It was interesting to see him as the connecting thread. And I thought he played a good role.
Me too. No, I like what you say there, because especially since he and Iris are both the connections to Roy's past, as you say, and Roy is afraid of his past. That's, you know, that's throughout the whole thing, that metaphorically and actually afraid of his past. And Iris comes there to tell him, look, you can be afraid. You can try to run from your past. You can try to forget your past. You can try to lie about your past, but the past is there, and the past, and it happened, and the past is what made you who you are. So there's the whole bit. You live two lives. It's basically what you live. You're a kid when you get to make mistakes, and then you're an adult when you get to live with all those mistakes you got to make when you were a kid. And that's what he needs to realize. And it's through that, and that's what Robert Duvall's, Max's whole point is, wants to. He represents the point of threatening him with the bad parts of his past. And Iris is there to remind him, your past isn't all bad. Your past involves me. Your past involves something that you don't even know about, how great it was. And you've got to stop thinking that this is all about you being the best baseball player in the world. And, you know, because he's like having the greatest season that anyone's ever had, you know, in the world. But he's disappointed because he could have had all this more as the standard. If only I could have. Well, You didn't. So here you are.
So despite the fact that Max is trying to straddle between the good and the light and the dark, the connections to the past are Iris is the connection to the light and Max is the connection right. to the dark.
That's right. really cool.
It wasn't until he met Max, yeah, that he got involved. Well, not even involved. I mean, he hadn't even done anything and he gets shot by this crazy person. I do think it's interesting, though, that Max's last name is Mercy. The names in the movie mm-hmm. feel pretty deliberate.
Well, yes. That's...
Like Hob, for example, is a nickname for the devil, which I think is an interesting choice for Roy's last name. But the fact that Max's last name is Mercy, I thought was kind of odd. And I was trying to the whole movie to figure out why they would have gone with that as his last name. But I don't
know. I think he's Mercury. He is meant to be. I think it's like coming
Mercurial.
From Mercurial, slippery, quicksilver kind of thing.
Could be.
It very well could be.
Snake in the grass, just to kind of double down on the devil imagery.
Pretty sure that that's...
We got a decent number of other characters in here, but the only other one that really, you know, stood out to me to have something to say about him was Robert Persky as the judge, or Prosky, excuse me. Because just about everything I've ever seen him in, he plays a likable, older... guy who's, you know, who you have a hard time to not like him. And now you put him and you're basically playing him against type because he is somebody that I would have, you know, the way I see it is that the general public would find him charming and likable, mm-hmm. but he's evil deep down inside and not all that deep down inside, almost on the surface, but that he fools most people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with his charming exterior and his, you know, avuncular nature and all of that, the way he talks. So I see him as the tempter, which yeah. no question he is. He's you know, offering bribes and he's offering Roy, who, you know, I mean, if you want to start going into the symbolism, he's our Christ figure.
Yes.
He's the devil offering him the easy way out.
Mm-hmm. He's even from the point of his character, as he says, he lives in darkness because he was afraid of the dark as a child. And so he thought he could get over his aversion to the darkness, which in our metaphor is a good thing. He thought he could seep himself in darkness in order to overcome it. But all it did was just he just became that, it. What yeah. he was trying to do to yep. escape.
Mm-hmm. To the point that he can't be in the light.
He can't be in the light.
So he's always in the dark. Yeah.
Yeah, which is definitely interesting. But before I move off the characters, is there anybody else that you guys found to be worthy of just pointing out or discussing at all?
I like the Bat Boy. Just a shout out to him. Because he was sweet. And I kind of like that he got to sort of be a representation of Roy as a kid. Mm-hmm. And Roy kind of got to be a little bit of like a father figure to this kid without realizing it. He was foreshadowing the fact that, you know, Iris's kid is, of course, mm-hmm. Roy's and all that. But I just thought the actor was charming and adorable. I thought he was really cute.
See, I do like Corny. And I mentioned Corny mm-hmm. before and I liked it. I would have liked in the final scene if he had been there, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It would have been nice to see like some kind of closure with him. But he was... like a tertiary character at best, I suppose.
Who's the Cyclops guy?
Gus.
Gus isn't or he might be now, but he wasn't in the credits originally because his character was added late. I guess I don't know if he's
listed as uncredited.
Yeah, listed as uncredited because he got added. The character got added late. Or it was a much smaller character and was going to expand it. And something with the guild rules meant he would have been paid less, so he chose to be uncredited, which wound up giving him more notoriety than he would have gotten otherwise. And,
but I see him as an extension of the judge. He's the yeah. judge's, you know, flunky.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's the...
He's an agent.
He's the agent of evil. He's...
Mm-hmm.
There's no secret to it. And he's one-eyed... things with eye issues in literature is always talking about deception. That's what a Cyclops is. It's like it doesn't see the whole picture and is trying to make you see things their way.
The Bat Boy served another purpose that I really liked. And it was a sequence with Iris where Roy's kind of you know, to a couple sequences with Iris. There's a sequence with Iris where he kind of apologizes to a certain extent to her. And what I mean by that is he comes clean about what happened on the train.
Right.
And she asks him some very honest questions about, you know, he had to reveal to her that he had feelings for the girl. Well, this is something where there was the promise that I'm going to send for you. Instead, he went down the path of the infatuation, and that led to the ultimate mistake that he ended up making down there. He was, tempted by the apple.
But ultimately, at the end of the movie, when he finds true happiness, it has nothing to do with being the star or being the hero. It has to do with finding his family, being the father, and kind of having the family life he was denied as a young boy.
Yeah.
And saving Pop.
And that's what Barbara Hershey's character, when he says that he wants, you know, when I walk down the street, they'll say, well, there goes Roy Hobbs, the best that ever was. And she's disappointed. And she says, isn't there anything else? You don't think there's anything more profound than that?
Yeah.
You know, and at the end of the movie, that's what he's learned is there is more than that.
There's way more.
Sorry, Sean, I kind of took over.
No, you're good.
Okay.
So, I mean, and that's, so then, again, going back to Iris, the sequence where she's talking to him later and trying to coach him in the fact that, no, you've made a mark. You've done more than you think. It's just not what you thought it should be. She's referring to the fact that he impacted kids, and we got to see that sequence where he did that. The Bat Boy in particular gives her that opportunity for this is this pivotal moment where what have you motivated this kid to be in the future? You know, what doorways have you opened for him?
That kid moved to Louisville and started a bat-making kind of...
Exactly. And he sought out tree after tree and some kind of major event to it.
it turns out, just to find the right one, he's deforesting half of the country.
That's right.
But he's got six bats to show for it.
That one was hit by a tornado. Let's make that into a bat.
So I said earlier... that this was Robert Redford's movie, that it's, you know, it stands on his shoulders. But I have to give credit where it's due. I think this film was really, really well directed by Barry Levinson. And I got to give equal credit to Caleb Deschanel, who was the cinematographer. The only failure in that, in my mind, was, again, at the beginning when Roy was supposed to be 19 years old. You needed to stay distant. You needed to go with darkness silhouettes, or you know, extreme light even would have kind of obscured his look a little. Excuse me. And I think that's the only area where I think that they could have done significantly better than they did. But beyond that, I think the movie is exactly what it needs to be. I think it has that classic feeling. I think it has a timeless feeling, and it just flows along to the point where what we talked about earlier, that it was 138 minutes, and it did not feel like 138 minutes to me.
I agree.
I shut you all up with my my pithy commentary.
You know, I will agree, because I don't feel like this was a movie that was made in 1984, you know, but, and oftentimes when I watch movies from earlier decades, the pacing will sometimes get to me, especially movies from like the 70s. I find they're just slower, you know, and I'm not used to that. And sometimes I like old movies, like the 1930s are for me the sweet spot for film, 1930s and 40s. But the pacing in this was, like, he gets shot within like the first 5 minutes of the movie, and it keeps you intrigued the whole time. I agree. It doesn't feel like it's super long. They did a good job with that.
Yeah, I like the last sequence too. You know, the iconic, absolutely everyone remembers that one, of course.
The last game.
That, much like It's a Wonderful Life, a lot of people just watch that, or watching the last part of the movie in context and out of context are two very different things. Mm-hmm. And you could get caught up in it because the explosion of lights is there to bring the metaphor home. And the sparks are raining down on the judge, for God's sake.
Yep.
And
you're on the money with that.
I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that in the, where he broke the clock in Wrigley Field and everybody leaves, they were the visiting team. The Cubs would have had another at bat I don't know where everyone's going. Maybe it was just
good point. Good, very good point. I was surprised to find out that Randy Newman did the soundtrack, the score. Although, you know, I mean, he does seem to be perfect for a baseball movie. But the score has a feel to me, you know, like, again, like the movie itself, it feels like it has a callback kind of feeling to it. It doesn't feel like something from the 1980s. You know, and I'm just looking at on Wikipedia, it says the film score of The Natural was composed and conducted by Randy Newman. Score has often been compared to the style of Aaron Copland and sometimes Elmer Bernstein. So, you know, it obviously I'm not the only one who thought that this had, you know, more of an old time feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think it's the horns.
Yeah, very much. Let's
good use of
it. This is going to sound like blasphemy, but I don't find it. I find it about a basic. It's a basic soundtrack. It's with an extremely memorable theme because of the parts in the movie, the way that it's used, you know, with the home. It's been associated and will be associated with home runs.
Forever.
But other than that, I can't remember any of the, if I'm like walking along trying to remember what the theme sounds like, the rest of it, I can't. I know Iris has a theme, but I don't quite know what it is.
And it is pretty.
It is pretty.
But that's my point sometimes. Yeah. I think it's important for the score to underline the feelings you should have or kind of point you towards the feelings that you should have. But it shouldn't always take over the scene. And absolutely. I think this one does that effectively for the most part. And then, like you say, when it calls for it, it builds up to a, you know, a crescendo. But it, you know, Iris's theme, yeah, no, it doesn't stand out to me, but I know that there's one there. And like you said, it's kind of like a pretty sound to it. And that's all it needed to be. That's, in fact, I think that's exactly what it needed to be. I thought it was fitting for that reason.
It's kind of funny. If we do, For Love of the Game ever, the soundtrack of that, I think it's Goldsmith does that. And it's very much meant, it's very evocative of this soundtrack, but that one's more memorable.
See, I don't remember anything about the score in that movie.
For me, I've seen that movie.
But all day I've been playing the because the thing is the theme, the home run theme from The Natural goes very well into the theme of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. And so in my head, I kind of just go from like one that to the other and then back again. I've been doing that all day.
It's a blessing and a curse to have our brains for music. Like if anybody ever says a seven syllable anything, I'll go, Maggie and I will just go do-da, do-da.
I think its most critical job was kind of what we've been talking about throughout all this. It made this film feel like it was in a different time.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was something I thought the film very successfully did, you know, for the pieces, however you feel about the over the top nature of certain sequences of it. It did not feel like it took place when the film was released.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that in 84. And I think now when you look back at most movies from that era, there's not a lot of films that you can like distinctively say felt like they were in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
I think
Redford's in a lot of them.
Yeah.
Funny you say that. Yeah, because the only other one I can think of is The Sting, which is one of my favorite movies.
Butch Cassidy. Yeah.
Yeah. Like again, that one has a timeless feel to it that it feels like it was made in the era it's depicting, and I have to consciously remind myself, absolutely no, it was not.
Can I pose a question to the group? Because this is when I asked Maggie last night, and we weren't able to answer it. Do you guys think this was a good baseball movie?
Oh, yeah.
Is a different question about the movie's quality. Is it a good baseball movie?
I'm going to say no. I'm going to say that it's very unrealistic. It gives you, you know, it's very unrealistic in some events and some things. It gives you the right feel.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, like when he goes into a slump or when he's not in a slump or when he's hot, it gives you the right feel for that. That's, you know, that's the way it feels when a player is in a slump. That's the way it feels when a player is really hot. But was it realistically shown I don't think it was, because I think, you know, when he's hot, he's hitting a home run every time he's up at bat. And when he's on a slump, he isn't getting a hit for 50 at bats. Mm-hmm. I think it's, you know, it's overemphasized a little bit to get that feeling. So is it realistic? No. But does it kind of create that feeling just the same? Yeah. So it's kind of, I'm kind of waffling on your question. You know, it's also, you know, they're in last place, then they're in second place, then they're in last place again, then they're in first place. It's like, none of that is realistic, but it gives you, you know, in a 2-hour movie, 2 hours and 20 minutes, it gives you the feeling of what it's like to go through a pennant race and the feeling what it's like to go through a slump and feeling what it's like to have a player who's really hot. So it's realistically, my answer is yes and no. It does give you the feelings, but it's not realistically portrayed.
I think it can. The superhero piece is one that I can't escape of this. It's like a superhero baseball movie. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the pieces it does do well is there are certain games in the film where there's this need for a comeback. There's a need for that moment. I think any of us who really enjoy baseball, some of your favorite games are those ones where it looked like it was going one way and it turns, some pivotal moment starts turning it the other way. Mm-hmm. I think it does capture that, yes, in a very over-the-top superhero way, and that type of thing, but that emotion's still there. It's something I love about baseball. There's something about when you see these multiple innings where there's no score, or one or two runs, or something very, very basic that's going on, the one team is like been front loaded where like they had a great first couple of innings. Then the game has that piece where it's kind of like, are they going to go up to bat and hit anything at all? And there's sequences in this where it captures that.
I think you're describing what I was saying, that it captures the emotion of those things.
Yes, and I like
even that. If it's not totally realistic in the way it's portrayed.
Yeah. So, and I would go as, oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I'd go as far as to say that the baseball that is in the movie is well shot and it's well portrayed, like the actual baseball play itself. I enjoy kind of like the plane scenes from Top Gun being my favorite parts of Top Gun, or the bits with the planes in them. But it's not really a baseball movie. Right. It's a movie with baseball in it.
That's what I think. I don't think it is a baseball movie. This is a superhero movie that has baseball as a backdrop.
Not only that, it was Lightning that wanted this one guy to play baseball.
Yes, but
Lightning gave him a baseball bat.
But the thing is the baseball in it is amazing. It's probably some of the best shot baseball I've ever seen. It's amazingly shot. The scenes are good. They get the tension down, like you were saying. Robert Redford probably...
He learned how to throw a ball.
He learned how to throw a ball. Yeah.
I think Robert Redford, if I heard right, I think he might have played some college ball himself. Robert Redford looked like a ball player.
Yeah. That,
but Robert Redford looked like he knew how to swing a bat. Robert Redford looked like he knew how to throw a ball.
Just and like Kevin
Costner. Unlike, say, Tim Robbins in Bull Durham.
Yeah, we won't.
But Costner's good at
Costner's fairly good, but Robert Redford was just great.
Yeah.
It's baseball. It kind of needed to be baseball at the end, because only a baseball game could have been the means, if not boxing, you know, if we're hit with the thing. But there was one thing I was going to say. I'll probably forget it now. Mm-hmm. Yes.
If you think of it before we end the call, you let me know. So unless anybody has anything else of any significance, we can rate this.
Hang on, because I was really excited to talk about this movie, because while I was watching it, all I can think is, what a weird way to tell a baseball story. And then I was thinking, it's going to be so much fun to talk about this for the podcast. I want to make sure I haven't forgotten anything. And I don't think I have. I feel like we've very thoroughly covered this movie.
I remember what I was going to say.
Well, then go ahead.
The way that baseball helps the metaphor out is because Roy Hobbs is as having to realize that he's more than just an action guy. He's a hero. In baseball is probably is a team sport made up of the sum total of individual actions. But one player is way less likely to, by their own actions, influence the game than in, say, basketball. LeBron James can just have the greatest game of his life and can score every, you know, point in the fourth quarter and extra or in overtime, you don't get the, even if Roy gets a hit every time he goes up, you know, if nobody else is on base, that's four runs or four home runs if he hits four home runs. But his presence, like Superman's, like Jesus, like Wally, like any sort of Messiah figure, makes the rest of the people try harder. The team gets better by him getting better.
Like when they put the lightning patches
exactly. on. Exactly. That was the whole thing.
That was really sweet.
And that's why it's...
They didn't put any sort of thing for Bump who got killed, but that's besides the point.
Well, you know... Yeah,
that was such a weird
He owed all of the money.
He goes through the wall. The last thing I expected was for him to die. I was like, I thought he'd be injured.
It was so funny. She's watching. She goes, hey, movie!
Yeah, movie! What are you doing? You killed him? And then you spread his ashes over the field and they immediately start playing. And I was just like, "That okay, all right, whatever. I guess we're moving on."
It always brings me back to the movie The Jerk when, what's it, Maurice Evans' wife is the maid. And there's a scene, she's on a firing squad and they shoot her. And in the narration, Steve Martin's saying she withdrew money early and had to pay a substantial penalty. And Maurice Evans is looking out the window and Steve Martin says, oh, can you do whatever? And he says, one can't mourn forever. Anyway, Sean, you had a point?
Oh, no, I was just being silly. I was going to say they made a bat out of the wood where he crashed into the wall.
Piece
of lumber, Billy.
100%, yeah. The little bit of Bump's blood on him. Yeah.
Oh, that's how ultimately they won the game. You know, like, yeah.
All right, so back to rating. I'm going to say when I watched this in the 80s, and I didn't like it, and I thought it was silly, and I still said, oh, how could people like this or whatever. If I was realistic, based upon how I felt at that time, it still wasn't like a Jaws 4. It would have been a Jaws 3 by my reckoning. You know, it was okay, but, you know, nothing special. Now I watched it, and I really enjoyed it, and I think I have to reel myself in the same way. Despite really enjoying it, I don't think it's a perfect movie. I don't think, although it could be called a classic, no question. But I don't think I can rate it as a Jaws, even as much as I did enjoy it this time. So I think I'm going to put it as a pretty high Jaws 2.
So for me, obviously, I mean, it's not like it's going to be a big shock to anybody listening to this. I wanted to talk about this film. This is a Jaws for me. Now, I'm going to echo something that Paul said, though. It's not a perfect movie. The bump sequence for me is, you know, like it's something I have a major issue with. That being said, the rest of the film, even the fantastical bits and all that, I love this film because I can watch it as comfort food and just stay very surface level with it and just enjoy hanging out with Roy for a bit. But then when you really start thinking about this film, the most fun I had today was the fact that we had four different people on this talking about this film. And I was just as intrigued by the fact that whether we wound up in the same spot or different spots, usually we kind of got there a little bit differently for each person who got there. I really was enjoying a lot more than sharing my own thoughts, hearing what everybody else was saying about how they got where they got to, because it made me kind of like want to go then rewatch it again to kind of see, oh, how, let me see how they kind of arrived at that point. And that to me is a film that's a Jaws for me personally. So that's kind of why I wanted to talk about this film. I surprisingly got more out of this than I thought that we could have gotten out of it. And I appreciate the fact that the three of you indulged me in talking about a particular film.
Problem.
Because I really enjoyed hearing more what you all had to say about this one.
I'd rather hear that than, for the love of God, John, are you ever going to shut up?
No, I gotta echo what Sean said. I would say that you guys brought a lot to the table on this one, and I appreciate that.
Well, we have to. It's baseball. It deserves it.
Yeah.
But now you got to give your ratings.
You want to rate it first?
I'll give it. It's Jaws for me, and which is the movie. Despite all of my honest praise on this, the question of do I enjoy this movie is probably no. I enjoyed it this time less. It's all of the things I said there, I agree with. It is clearly a very well-made movie with very good performances on this. But for me, by now, I think it is just so on the numbers. You know, they're called the Knights because I guess the Argonauts would have been too on the nose kind of thing. But it is what it is. It is that story. It's just I don't really love it as much. And as I said, I don't think it's a baseball movie at all, despite having baseball in it. That said, the very fact that the score is instantly recognizable as being the bit from The Natural and will be associated with home runs forever. And it's iconic. It's well done and everything. And it's a classic. It's going to be talked about forever. We had an incredible talk about it today and it was great. And that to me means, you know, it's a Jaws.
So, you know how there's Lion King 1.5? I kind of feel like if there was a Jaws 1.5, that's what I'd give this. Like I'm with Paul. I'd give it a high Jaws 2. The magical elements to me are no different than the magical sort of elements from Field of Dreams. The bad luck and the jinxes and the superstitions and the curses, that's all a part of baseball. Baseball's got a lot of that kind of mysticism to it. And baseball sort of lends itself to magic because it is a magical game. And while the movie isn't a great baseball movie, it's a good movie. I enjoyed watching it with John. I didn't enjoy like every part of the movie, but you don't have to enjoy it overall. And it made made me appreciate my baseball. I got a little bit of a baseball fix from it, paradoxically. While I had fun like picking apart the other bits of it and everything. So overall, it was a very enjoyable experience. And while I know that the book is nothing like the movie, it still made me want to read the book just to find out what the hell story is this. You know, so I'm curious to read the book and just give it a whirl. But I guess to give it an official rating, I'd say Jaws 2 over Jaws, but otherwise Jaws 1.5.
Right, fair enough. And thank you guys for coming on. I really enjoyed having this chance to talk about this. And like I said, I think you brought a lot to the table and made it even more enjoyable. Well, thank you for making the time.
It's always great to be here.
Yeah, we love coming on.
And well, you know what? Just for anybody listening, you know, we were talking before about how it's been a lot longer since we talked than I realized. And we keep talking about, oh, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. So, yeah, we're going to. I think, okay. You know, we're before this baseball season is over, we're going to do For the Love of the Game.
Yeah.
And at some point in the not too distant future, we're going to get to our long talked about review of Blazing Saddles.
Yeah, that is for sure, because we were talking about that the other day.
Yeah.
And Maggie wants to also do Robin Hood Men in Tights because that.
Oh, I mean, if we're going to do Mel Brooks, it's just I grew up with Robin Hood Men in Tights. That was the first Mel Brooks movie I ever saw.
So that would be.
That's fine with me. You know what? We've already done Young Frankenstein together, so you are my Mel Brooks people.
That's good. For a second, I thought we were just the Randy Newman people. Randy Newman had the opening song in Major League.
In Major League, too, yeah.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, thanks, guys, for coming on. I really appreciate it, and thank you, everybody, for listening, and play ball.
Let's play ball.